If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If there's one muscle that you can flex, it's learning to do the same thing over and over again. Like one of the values that we had at Gym Launch is do the boring work, because boring is what makes you rich, right? It's writing the follow-up sequence to the purchase page that you don't feel like doing, but you know you should do. It's running the split test for the 10th time. It's actually going through and prepping for 20 minutes before you have the meeting, because it's amazing how much smarter you can appear with 20 minutes of preparation. Like, you can appear 50 IQ points smarter if you just prepare for meetings for 20 minutes.
If life is a long journey of self-acceptance, I think the earlier you can accept your own peculiarities as just part of you, rather than trying to justify them or mold to what you, to the archetype that you think is acceptable within your social circle. At least for me, like, there's this period of discomfort when you change anything because everyone around you wants you to fit within the label that they are comfortable with.
But they also have the anchor of what you were before.
Yeah, exactly. And so they try and, like, they people don't like that. And so they're like, no, I like you in this box. So just say, I know you're having a little thing right now. Don't worry. Just, and they just want to shove you back into it. And there's a lot of uncomfortable conversations that you have to have where it becomes really socially awkward. And so, like, I said one the other day about, like, going home for the holidays, and the reason I don't like doing it is because often I have to confront a lot of people that I haven't seen in a long time, and they'll speak to me in a way that I don't like. And before that, I would roll it off, like, whatever, no big deal. But I don't accept that.
Champions are broken. I was like, huh. He's like, people look at champions and try and find something that champion has that they don't have. He's like, but it's not that at all. He's like, they lack something everyone else has, which is an off button. They just don't stop. And at the end of the day, like, if we're optimizing for outcomes, then the most broken person will win. The person who has the absolute biggest, you know, desire for achievement, the absolute biggest fear or pain that they're running away from, and the hardest impulse control. Now, impulse control, most people would agree, is a good thing. The other two, not as much. And so, what are we optimizing for? What problem are we solving? It's my favorite. It's probably the number one most frequently asked question that I ask to our portfolio companies whenever we're about to do anything, which is, what problem are we solving? If the problem that we're solving is that I want to be content, well, there's a lot of ways to do that. You don't need to do all these other things. If the problem you're solving is that you want to be the richest man in the world, well, you're going to have a lot of superiority complex. You're going to have a lot of crippling insecurity, and you're going to have a lot of impulse control, and you're going to have to wait a long time.
I think what a lot of people don't get, myself included, when I was earlier starting, is people don't get the amount of volume that it takes to be successful, right? Like, I'll tell you, I had a different conversation the other day. So, good friend of mine, very successful, and like to the B level successful, right? And so he had a conversation with me. He's wanted to start building a personal brand just because he wants to give back. And he was like, dude, why? He's like, your stuff just crushes compared to mine. Like, what am I doing wrong here? And I gave him a couple tips. And then he was like, well, how much content are you guys putting out a week? And I was like, I think we're at like 350 pieces a week. And he just, like, he looked at me and he was like, thank you for resetting my minimum standard. And because he's an experienced entrepreneur, and so he could immediately translate that into what he needed to hear, because he was like, me with my one a day. He's like, I think it's significantly less reasonable that I expect to have your outcome with 1/30th of the level of volume that you're putting out.
What actions I'm willing to take despite the judgment of others. And so a lot of times, and it might be because I have more insecurity than everyone, that I think, like, man, I want to do this thing. And then I hear all these other voices of reasons why I shouldn't do it, or why somebody else will say, like, that's bad, or you're bad, or like, that's wrong, whatever. And so I think I've had to come up with a lot of these devices to get around my own insecurities, to take action despite those insecurities. And the biggest one that I think about is that it doesn't matter whether I achieve all of my goals or I don't achieve all of the goals. In three generations, I'll be forgotten. And the only people who were naysaying against me will also be dead. And so then it's like, just do it for me. And then when I wake up every day, there's only one voice I have to listen to.
I had a mentor way back when I was starting my gyms, and he was like, yeah, we do flyers. That's how we get customers. So I was like, okay, so I'll do some of those. He said, you should try that. So, you know, print out 300 flyers, and, you know, advertising was expensive and I was broke. And so 300 was the appropriate amount of advertising that I could stomach. And so we put out 300 flyers and I waited. And then the next day I got a call. I was real excited. And as soon as I pick up the phone, I was like, oh, hey. And it's like, I got one of your flyers. I was so excited. And he says, yeah, you dinged my Mercedes. And I just immediately panicked and hung up the phone. I didn't even say anything. Thankfully, he never called back. But that was the only call I got from my 300 flyers. And so I called the mentor back and I was like, hey, you told me to do that, you know, think, you know, a decade plus ago and way more entitlement. I was like, hey, you told me this was going to work. Right. And he didn't even respond to that. He was like, well, how many did you put out for your test size? And I was like, what do you mean by test size? He's like, well, what was the first batch that you tested on so that you could then scale it? And I was like, well, I mean, I put out 300 in total. And he just started laughing. And I was like, why? I'm having this very serious moment. You know what I mean? I was like, what are you laughing at? He's like, hard to know if anything works with 300. He's like, well, we test with 5,000. He's like, and then if we get 0.5% back, he's like, then we're okay. 1%, I'm scaling to the moon. 1.5, he's like, I'm singing praises. He's like, if you had 0.5% on that, he's like, you'd get 1.5 people. He's like, and that's tough to see with 300. Can't really know if anything's working. And I remember thinking that moment, like, I might have been doing the right thing, but I was not doing nearly enough of it. And I think that there's a lot of early on, and like, I think that story can apply to a lot of things, to early entrepreneurship. It's like, we can get disheartened by our first month of making content that we haven't made money yet from it. But it's like, not that you're doing the wrong thing. You just might not have been doing it either long enough or enough of it, which time is really just also a proxy for doing enough of it.
One of my biggest inspirations, or whatever, you know, influences when I was in Baltimore was I would have lunch with my grandfather 3 times a week. So he was 90, old guy. So I'd go to the nursing home and we'd have lunch 3 days a week. And listening to him talk about the regrets that you had in life, it's so much more painful to watch someone who has no options left. Like, he's going to die. I mean, he's going to die tomorrow. And he died a couple of years later. I mean, like, and he lost all his mental faculties, you know, almost sadly. Basically, when I left Baltimore, one of the sad parts is I was one of the only people that kind of like kept him lucid. You know what I mean? And after that, no one really visited him. No one really did anything. And so I think he just rolled downhill. I think the lunches might have been the only thing that he looked forward to. And seeing someone old with no options and nothing but regret. Now, not that he had everything to regret. He had things that he did really well. And I took those things from him. He would repeat the same lessons. You know, like every lunch, let's be real, a lot of older people kind of repeat a few key lessons. And he always used to say, he's like, you have 2 hands and 1 brain. He's like, use them.
You know, girlfriend breaks up with you. Okay. Then you go into work and you sulk because you're distracted. And then you don't do the same level of effort and you're not enthusiastic. And then all of a sudden your work suffers and you get put on a PIP or you get fired. And then now you're fired and you don't have a girlfriend. And then you start gaining weight and you stop going to the gym. And all of a sudden you're like, man, bad things happen in threes. It's like, no, bad things happen all the time. And they only become interrelated if you let it affect your behavior. And so I think the equal opposite of that is thinking, okay, this bad thing occurred. What can I do to decrease the likelihood something else bad occurs in the meantime? And then boiling everything down to activities or the actions that I have to take. And I think about that actually a lot, which is how, like, if you think about from the power perspective of, okay, something bad happens, how much will it affect my behavior? Well, the person who is indestructible would have something terrible happen and then nothing would change. And I love that.
Or they'd get better.
Exactly, yeah.
You can define commitment by eliminating alternatives. So if you're committed, you've eliminated alternative actions, right? Like, you can say I'm committed, but until you eliminate other options, you're not committed.
There's always a get out of jail free card.
Right. And so a lot of people make decisions to end relationships, to quit their job, to start the new thing, but they don't become committed to the decision until they remove the other options. And then you're forced to take action on it. And so I think actually defining those two different things. Now, you could define, you know, decision as to kill off, like dicadere from Latin. But from a colloquial thing, I think there are two different instances. It's like, I need to change this, and then I do change it. And the making the decision is when it becomes a commitment. Every worthwhile goal is worthwhile because it has a cost associated with it. And so the cost that you're going through is what makes the goal worthwhile to begin with. Because if what you were setting out to do were immediately available to you, then it would mean it would be immediately available to everyone, which means it wouldn't be worthwhile. So the very fact that it's difficult is why it is worth doing. And so, like, we can't resent the price tag of the shoes that we want to buy. We just have to make the decision of whether or not we want to pay it.
What's your downside? Shame? Shame is your downside? Someone wagging their finger at you saying you broke a rule that doesn't exist, that I made up to make you feel bad? Them. You're going to die. And so are they. So get what you want.
Whenever I like, it gets really hard. And I just think to myself, like, why am I even bothering? Why should I even keep doing this? I just remind myself that this is where most people stop. And this is why they don't win. And so that's a quote that has helped me get through some of those, like, really tough times. It's like, well, do I want to win more than I want to fail? Yes. It's like, well, then this is a Trevor quote, who's my editor and my closest friend. He said, well, whenever someone says they can't stand it anymore, he said, well, if you're alive, you have proof that you can stand it. And if you die, you won't have to stand it anymore. So you can always stand it. And I think that's a really powerful message. It's really simple. But, like, if you are going through it, then you are going through it. You may be uncomfortable. It may be painful. You may hate it. But you're still here.
You accept outcomes and you accept circumstances. You accept the fact that you were dealt whatever hand you were dealt. You accept that you're 5'8". You accept that you're black. You accept that you're a woman. That's accepting. You trying to rebel against that is you trying to fight the universe, and the universe is going to win every time. But in terms of you framing acceptance as saying that I am comfortable with who I am and I cannot be better and I must be satisfied with that, is the biggest embodiment of failure that I can imagine. Is that it's almost egotistical to say that there's a difference between saying I am good enough and I am good. So you could say I am good enough for my current state based on the work that I've put into it. But I could be better. And so, like, you can accept that the work that you have done has created the outcome that you've created, but you do not need to accept that the outcome that you've created is the end all be all and the last outcome that you need to have. And so for me, like, the only version of acceptance that I have is that I accept that the version of myself that I want to be is so far from who I am that I have this massive discrepancy that I have to overcome. And then just breaking that down one step at a time and thinking, I don't deserve to be that man, but I can still do the things that can create it. And that also means that I have to go through the circumstances that would create that man, which means that if I have unbelievable big dreams and big goals, then I have to go through hard times. It's like hate. The hard times are a requisite for success. And so if you're going through hard times right now, it means that you're on the path to success. And it's not that you're on the wrong path. It's the feeling of being on the right path.
Hard work is the goal. And so it's not like work hard so that X. Because as soon as you have a so that, then the X is the thing. But if the goal is to work as hard as you possibly can, then the only real output we have is who we become along the way. And so in reframing that, then it's something that I can win or measure myself against every day in real time throughout the day, which is how hard am I working? Because that is the goal. And then even I say this just for audio, but like everything else takes care of itself, still puts the everything else as the goal still. It's just being vaguer. But if you just say like the only point is working hard, because I know that whatever I'm going to get is stuff that I will become accustomed to. And the, I guess, opposite of the hedonic treadmill is like the resilience piece is that my ability to work hard itself is growable. And so I just need to keep my RP, my rate of perceived exertion, at 8 or 9 or 10, because I know that when I look back on my life, the days that I loved the most were days when I had nothing left in the tank.
Figure out what you want. Ignore the opinions of others.
and do so much volume that it would be unreasonable that you would be unsuccessful.
Like, I get criticized all the time for work-life balance. People are like, well, you don't have any hobbies, Alex, and you don't whatever, right? And I'm like, I don't want any. So why do I have to sacrifice things that I would prefer to do things I don't want to do to satisfy your objective measure of what you deem as work-life balance? Why?
I try to play games that I have variables that I have control over. And so I got this from my dad, actually. But he said, I only play games if I know I'm going to win. And people might take that and take a lot of different things from it. But I'll tell you what he meant by that. Was that he wanted to do all the preparation and have all the unfair advantages he possibly could before taking the first step into a game. And I would say that that's probably the biggest difference between people who are big time winners and everyone else, is that, like, once you learn the rules of the game, then you learn how to stack the deck. And you can do it ethically and you can do it legally, right? Like, easy way to stack the deck, wait longer than your competition, right? Like, you can come in with unfair advantages simply by measuring success on different time horizons or measuring a different metric for success, right? Like, right now, what am I optimizing for? I'm optimizing for brand. I'm not optimizing for money, right? So I'm measuring something different than somebody else might be. And so someone who maybe started making content at the same time as me might be making more money than me today. But are they winning? I don't know. We're playing different games, right?
I think a lot of people are looking for something that is very hard to find. And so, and then they attribute their lack of success or lack of action because they don't have passion or motivation, right? And I would read all the self-help books. I read, like, every night, that's all I did. I just read all these self-help books. And I found one of them that said, there are people who are wantrepreneurs and entrepreneurs. And I remember hearing that word wantrepreneur, and I was like, it made me feel sad. I was like, I don't want to be fucking wantrepreneur. I was like, I'm not some bitch. Like, you know, but I was like, what if they're right? I am a wantrepreneur. I'm not an entrepreneur. I want to be one, and I'm not. And from that point, it took me 6 months to quit my job to actually decide to do the entrepreneurial thing. And I think in the early days, people are looking for the big carrot. They want the big vision. They want the big passion, but they don't have it. But I'll give you the first rule of entrepreneurship that I've learned, which is use what you have. And a lot more people have pain. A lot more people have anger. A lot more people have shame. And if you can use that as your gas in the beginning, you'll eventually get to a point where you can get out of that loop and then find something that you are really passionate about. But if you can't tie your shoes, you can't lift the weight, you can't send the DM, then you have to start with whatever you have. And so for me, it was hatred of my current existence. I hated being a entrepreneur. I hated being a wannabe. I hated being one of those people who, like, talked about all the things they were gonna do and didn't do anything. I hated living the life that my dad wanted me to live. I was his bitch. That's what it was. I was his bitch. I was living his dreams out, not mine. And that was, you know, led to that other tweet, which was, sometimes your parents' dreams have to die in order for yours to live. And for me, I realized that the idea that my father had of me as his son, that image had to die in order for the image of myself that I wanted to be to live. Because I kept trying to quit my job and go be an entrepreneur. And every time I'd have the conversation, be like, ah, come over, we'll talk about it, we'll have dinner, you know what? And he'd always talk me off the ledge. It was always over and over again.
Good salesman.
Yeah.
The work you do is the only thing you control, and the person you become becomes the evidence of the work that you voluntarily subjected yourself to. And not only does that pain or that difficulty or discomfort make you better, it's also what separates you from everyone else. And whenever I do go through those moments, I do have these slight, like, crook of the smile, you know what I mean? Crook of my lip that goes up, because I'm reminded that everything that I'm willing to tolerate and deal with is what everyone else who wants to do the same thing will be incapable of doing. If it's hard for me, it will be just as hard for somebody else. And I think for some reason, that gives me some sadistic pleasure that I will be able to keep moving forward.
So if someone says, you're not like everyone else, then you can just reframe that as, like, I am exceptional. And that's not a bad thing. And I actually think that most people have, like, this might be counter to most people's beliefs, but I think most people have the potential to be exceptional. And because most people are peculiar in their own way, they just stifle that because they want to be accepted by most people, but in so doing, never accomplish what they want to do because they conform. And so like if there's probably a lot of things about the world or even your world around you that you're like, this never made sense to me, but then you do it anyways. And I think that a lot of innovation and a lot of what makes people exceptional is feeling, you know, thinking that thought or seeing that thing and then being like, huh, I don't think I'm going to follow that rule anymore. Like, why do I need to shower twice a day? Huh? Like, I don't know. Like, why do I need to wear different clothing? Huh? Like, there's just a lot of these social norms that people, you know, usually pass down to us or they're, you know, bred into us in high school and college and things like that. But it's like you see a guy who, you know, wears a cowboy hat and dresses a certain way. And he basically wants to say, I am this archetype of person. But if cowboy boots aren't as comfortable for you as New Balances are, and you know that and you still wear cowboy boots, I would call you a fraud. Because like that is like it's like a micro rebellion against yourself.
Yep.
It's like there is, and like I look at old people a lot because usually they don't give a shit anymore. They've just like given up.
I want to be very clear. People think that I'm this unemotional or zero affect person. It's not true at all. Of course I feel things. The difference is, so what? Like, I can feel terrible and still do the acts that increase the likelihood of success. It's not trying to negate the fact that you have emotions or that you have bad feelings. It's about continuing on the path one step in front of the other despite that. And I think that the more you learn that your actions do not need to be equated to how you feel, the more these feelings can just be in the backdrop, and ultimately they make you resilient.
Yeah, people don't know how to manage their emotions. I think the more, at least for me, the more I've tried to create space between how I feel and what I do, the more consistent my outcomes have been.
What do you mean?
So if I need to create content and I'm not feeling it, or I'm feeling tired or things like that, the more times I give into that excuse or that feeling, then the more superstitious I become about doing it in the future. Whereas a lot of times if I can just start when I am tired or when something is painful and then still execute about the same as before, I look at game tape or I look at video or look at the content from those sessions, for example, and I see that I remember feeling terrible during the session, but mm-hmm. you can't really see mm-hmm. anything. Mm-hmm. And I think the more times you get that loop going, the more you can separate how you feel and what is required. And the more times you do what is required to get what you want, the more times you get what you want.
The amount of times when I was on my lonely path where I was too different from the friends that I had, but not successful enough to be friends with the people that I wanted to be friends with, that's when you want people to root for you. That's when you want people to support you. Once you've already won, people are like, he's amazing, he's so good. But like, that's the time when you need it the least. And so you always have to be the person who roots for you before everyone else does. And it's usually a single clap in the auditorium for a very long period of time. It is a slow clap that's just you rooting for you. And that visual, I think, is one that you can kind of take because it is. People struggle to do things alone. And the path of the exceptional person is one of an exception, which means that you are not with other people. And rather than fighting that or bemoaning it, see it as an indicator that you're on the right path. Because if everyone else were cheering you on, then it means you're not in the right place, because it means you're just like everyone else and that's not where you want to be.
Most goals are attainable if you expand the time horizon, even enormous ones. Like, you can do anything in 10 years.
You could walk to the moon.
You can do anything. And so for me, I would say a naturally impatient person. Like, I tend to want things immediately now. And you know what? You probably are too. But once I defined patience as figuring out what to do in the meantime, it allowed me to control what I did. Because now, like, you and I are being patient for your stock investments. Right now, as we're on this podcast, we're being patient for that because we're doing things in the meantime. And so
Whenever I felt impatient and wanted to change course, I had to just redefine what do I need to do today. And if you are sad and impatient, then it means that right now you need to learn what the option is that you need to go pursue. And then that makes it very much under your control. And so step by step, each of these emotions over time, I spent a lot of time trying to define them out so that they no longer control me and I know how to solve them. And then now it just becomes a faster and faster muscle. Like, oh, I feel anxiety. That means that I have many options that I don't have priorities. Okay, what's my priority? And then all of a sudden, what used to take days of anxiety and feeling this, you know, frog in my throat was just, oh, I need to make a list of all the things that I'm looking at. Which one's the most important? Ignore the rest. And then, whew.
The more memories you have of hardship that you've been through, the more it stacks, the more it becomes a trait, the more it becomes ingrained in your behavior, and the more it takes to shake you because you're like, well, this is my baseline. This isn't even close. It doesn't even register on my scale of something that's an inconvenience. We've all met that person where, like, if a call gets moved or a dinner plate is late, it's like a nuclear bomb went off, right? It's like, well, what's the opposite of that? Like, what's the person who, like, it doesn't matter if a nuclear bomb went off, but all you see is a straight line, completely undisturbed by the things that are going around them? Because you can beat 99% of people without being smarter or luckier, but by being willing to endure pain and uncertainty for longer. It's hard for you, it's hard for everyone else. And most people avoid hard things, which is why you can beat most people by just trying and continuing to try. And the main thing is that I think most people don't even know what trying feels like.
When the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of change. And I think pain moves people far, far more effectively than pleasure does. Like, the easy thing to way to prove it is, like, point a gun at someone's head and you have absolute compliance and they will do what they need to do, right? Automatically, just like that. Like, death is the great motivator and the gun just reminds you. And so I think that if you can create the figurative gun to your head of the pain that you're experiencing, and then I'm a big fan of future casting out negative scenarios. So people talk about, like, positive visualization. I prefer negative visualization, which is, what if I keep doing what I'm currently doing for the next 10 years? What will my life look like then? That usually takes my current pain and then just magnifies it. And then that allows me to get my action threshold high enough that it goes over the edge so that I can take that first move. And so if you know what the inputs outputs are of what you need to do, the guy who has the little quote on his wall, and you figure out whatever fuel you've got, not the one you wish you had, but the one you've got, and you use that to do the first input, you've crossed the line. You're in the game.
I think anyone wants someone to go through pain, but I think that you want someone to grow. And think about the reason they call them growing pains. It's because as soon as you stretch past your potential, as soon as you get into an area that you haven't done before, it's uncomfortable. And so to get the adaptation from the extra stress, you have to have the extra stress to get the adaptation. And so you can beat 99% of people without being smarter or luckier, but by being willing to endure pain and uncertainty, that's a big one, uncertainty for longer. Because the fastest growth periods are often the most miserable. And so if you want progress, get used to pain. But if you want to earn $1 million, you have to endure $1 million worth of pain. And so I said there's two kind of categories there. One is the actual pain, and the other is the uncertainty. But the thing is a lot of the pain comes from the uncertainty.
I think a lot of entrepreneurship and even personal growth is training yourself on how you respond to hard. Because in the early days, hard was, ooh, stop. This isn't good. I should, this is a warning sign. This is a red flag. I should slow down, or I should stop, you know, I should pivot. But the more I think about it as a competitive landscape, as I'm clear on what this path is supposed to look like, and these rocks and these dragons are things that I'm going to have to slay along the way to get the princess or get the treasure, I get happier about the harder it is because I know that no one else will follow.
It's a selection effect.
And I think if you can shift from this is hard to no one else will be able to do this, then it flips from being this thing that you're like, oh, poor me, to, oh, poor everyone else who's going to have to fucking try. And I think that is so much more motivating as a frame for the exact same circumstance.
Self-love, if there is such a thing, isn't a wine and spa day. It's holding yourself to a higher standard than anyone else does. I think self-love is doing whatever you can to bridge the gap between who you currently are and who you believe you can become. And so the voice inside of your head that's never satisfied with your achievements isn't your insecurity. It's the part of you that knows that you can do more.
So don't listen to people who are like, ignore that little voice. It's like, no, that little voice is knocking on your head being like, dude, you can do better than this. Like, we don't have to accept this reality. Like, we can be more.
The more you do, the more you realize you can do. And so it's like you prove to yourself in some way that you get a positive reinforcement loop that, like, if I spend an extra 50% longer on this, I get even more positive feedback. And so in some ways you could say that I've just become addicted to that loop, which is that the more obsessive I become about anything, the more positive feedback I get on a longer time horizon. And that's the part that most people struggle with.
Most of the pain that people experience is purely in their own minds. You have nothing to lose. And that means that you can take lots of risks very quickly and end up in the exact same position you are, which is nothing. And so if you eliminate downside, it should decrease your action threshold, meaning you should be able to do more things faster rather than do fewer things because you don't have a great life or things going for you. And so I think if people flip that, a lot more people would take action because they actually realize the advantage of their position.
The people who, you know, mean a lot to you won't remember you to a degree, sure. It whenever I have my harder times, that's my like reminder to self of the absurdity of it all, which is like someone's gonna argue over what appetizer they're gonna serve when I die. This probably doesn't matter that much.
So I spent 5 years building a chain of gyms. So I had 6 locations, and after that I sold 5 of them, I shut one down, and then I transitioned to doing turnarounds. In the transition between shutting my gyms down, I got a big payday because I sold my 5 gyms. Big for me, relative. I took all that money and I put it into the next thing. The partner that I had in that next thing ended up taking the money and disappearing, filing bankruptcy, and sending it to his girlfriend in Sweden. I couldn't make this up. So there was no way I could get the money back, and he had filed bankruptcy. There was no course of action for a lawsuit. And so a lot of people would probably go through that mental situation and think, and I went through this, was thinking, I just wasted the last 5 years. Like, I literally started a chain, built, like, put everything into the second location, put everything in the third location, the fourth location, the fifth location, kept going, right? I kept doubling down, and then I get my big payday, and I put it all on black, and then it disappears with one spin of the roulette. And so here I am, and I'm like, I have nothing to show for the last 5 years of work. But then in the next 12 months, I made more money than I had ever made in my entire life up to that point. The 5 years I made more profit the next 12 months than I made in the last 5 years times like 5. And it was because, and this is only, I was only able to realize this in retrospect, which is why I'm sharing it, which is that the thing that was the outcome of those 5 years was me and the skills and the experiences that I possessed through going through it. And so whatever the next mountain that you're trying to climb is, of course it's going to be higher, but it's going to require you to go through the smaller mountains to get to that point. So, because the more able you are, the more able you realize you can become. And you will get way bigger outcomes from the things that you have, like the path that led you here, than you think you can. That's why since that moment where I lost everything, and then I was able to make more in the next 12 months, I realized that no work is wasted because I am the output of the work, not the outcome. And that was one of the biggest frame shifts for me in never thinking that work is wasted, because the more I work, the bigger my work ethic, the more my work capacity increases.
It's not about coming up with the plan or doing the plan, it's sticking with the plan. Right, you can beat most people at anything if you just stick with it for a year. If you're willing to suck at something for 100 days in a row, then you could beat most people at most things. The bar for excellence has never been so low. And so most of your competition quits after the first sign of difficulty, the first impasse on the mountain where they don't immediately get it, because they've never known what hard feels like. And so you having to figure something out, the unknown is the hard part. The figuring it out is the hard part.
People who are most successful, a lot of times, it's not that they necessarily have more willpower. They find other ways to reward themselves. And so he's like, the more skills you have, the more ways you have to reward yourself. And so somebody can extend how long their time horizon is because they do gamify it. So people who don't have the skills of figuring out ways to reward themselves in the meantime can't make it the whole way. But that's like when you're doing cardio and you're like, okay, it's 5:30, you know, it's 5 times 5 to get out of here, right? You create micro games within the longer game to keep yourself going.
A lot of suffering that we incur is optional.
It mostly happens in our own mind to things that never actually occur in reality.
Every single person who wants to do something with their life and has done something with their life has gone through the exact chapter that you're going through. And it's the lonely chapter. It's the chapter where you don't fit in with your own friends, but you don't have the outcomes yet to fit into a new group of friends. And you're doing this thing, you're consuming content on the internet, you're doing these free tutorials online to try and figure out how to set up a podcast and where do I host this thing? And then you're going through this and you're like, is this even worth it? Because you have no signs of success, right? But if there's anything that you can take away from what we're saying right now is that the sign of success is the hate that you get along the way. And what you can't do is bend the knee to their hate and fit back into the conformity because it's comfortable and it's warm. Because like in the Matrix, when Trinity opens the door, when Neo's about to go take the red pill and he wants to get out of the car, she says, Neo, you've been down that road and you know exactly where it leads. And I know that's not where you want to be. And then he closes the door. Like right now, this moment that you're going through is Trinity opening the door and being like, you could go back, but then you'd have to remember exactly what the reason was that you decided not to go out to begin with, just because you listen to this podcast and you consume this content. You're like, I can fucking do more than this. Like, because you are starting to live in some of that, how where you look in the mirror and you're like, I can do more. And you start to see the person that you could be. And you're like, this does start to feel like hell.
Nothing great was ever achieved by people who tried to be great at all things. And so I was like, okay, I might not have a great relationship for a long period of time. I mean, there was like a lot of people don't know this, but in the early days of our relationship, even when we were married, I told Leah, so the first 3 years, I said the business comes before our marriage. So a lot of people don't know that. And I was like, well, to me, it made sense. It was like, most people break up over money. The business makes money. So the business feeds us. And then we will be okay. That was kind of my thinking around it. And we eventually flipped that and said, like, if we're good, the business will be fine. But it took 3 years to get there. But all that to say, like, I think having periods of imbalance, and maybe to be fair, if I hadn't had that priority at that time, maybe Gym Launch wouldn't have been what it became. And so I can't look back and say, like, I should have done it different, because it's really easy to say that now. But like, I might not be here to say that if I had been that way.
If you want to feel more motivated, change who you compare yourself to. Our environment stretches the gap and you experience the deprivation. Rich people are more deprived of money than poor people because they compare themselves to richer people than poor people do. And so consider this extreme example. You've got the guy with a bag on his back, nothing else he needs. I have everything I need. Two, I need everything. Who's more deprived? So, you might be like, huh, this seems kind of dark. Is there a clean way to make this comparison without focusing on other people? Because that's what I would be asking. Yes, compare yourself to the person you genuinely want to become. That's how you can create the gap. The number one predictor of wealth is an IQ, gender, race, and this one startled me. It's the zip code you're born in. Kind of fucks with you a little bit. You're like, huh, it's not about race, it's not about gender, it's not even about IQ. It's just where you're born, which means it's the things that we compare ourselves to, because your environment sets your standards. If you change the environment, you change your behavior. This is why networks like this are so valuable. Like, you can basically get someone to do anything if you orient the environment the right way. I can get everyone here to take off their clothes if I make this 150 degrees in this room. I could. You could. If you change the environment, you can change behavior. If I told you to like, hey, everybody get naked, we'd be like, I'm good, Alex. Fair enough. Crank this thing to 150, people start stripping. I didn't need to say anything. The environment changed your behavior more than I ever could. This is why the places like this and networks like this are so valuable.
When losers go through hard, they think, poor me. When champions go through hard, they think, poor everyone else is gonna try and catch me, because they're gonna have to go through this too. And they're not going to make it. And so despite all the heart that you're going through, you just have to believe with all your heart that you're going to make it. Because the thing is, as long as you keep trying, you are making it. And one of the things that I've learned about success, to the degree that I can even say this, is that you become successful the moment you decide you are. Because there's always going to be another goalpost. And the thing is that your current self today is living a life that your past self once dreamed of. You've accomplished goals that you said would make you happy. You've accomplished things that you said would make you successful. And so success is very much in the eye of the beholder, including your own. And so that means that you can both be successful and be dissatisfied. They don't have to be mutually exclusive. And I think that's okay.
I didn't need to deserve success, but I could still have it if I did the things that created success. And so it felt like a cheat code where I was like, I can actually be a shitty person and horrible and suck at everything. But if I still work out and I still eat this way, I can still look this way, even though I don't deserve it. And that was like the first, it actually felt like, I was like, for anybody who hates themselves, you can hear me. That was like my first big shade, my first solace, my first foothold that I started getting on success was that I didn't need to deserve it. I could still have it anyways. And that was like very empowering for me.
So imagine you're talking to the creator of the universe about the person that you want to become. And so you say, you know, I want to be courageous. And the creator replies, then I will give you monsters that terrify you. That way you can conquer them. And you say, well, I want to be patient. And the creator replies, then I will make you work harder and longer and nothing will come easy to you. That way you can learn to wait. Or like, okay, well, I want to be wise. And so the creator says, then I will give you failures that will crush your spirit. That way you can learn the value of judgment. Then you say, that sounds like a hard life. Can you give me a good life? And the creator replies, just like we measure the quality of a blacksmith by the strength of his steel, I measure you by what you are at the end, not the fire and the hammer that it took to make you. A good life isn't an easy life. A good life makes you into a good person. And that, my child, is a hard life. It's about who we become doing the work more than the outcome from the work itself. And I love this, and this is a reframing of Proverbs, but the work works on you more than you work on it. Like in all labor, there is profit. Meaning we always benefit from work, even if the thing that we work on gets destroyed, even if you went bankrupt, even if you know that relationship didn't work out, even if that partnership falls apart. The work you did is eternal because it changes you.
But when I was poor, I was pretty happy. I was okay with being poor. And now that I am rich, I'll put quotes on that, it's about the same. And so then it just goes down to, well, then the richness had nothing to do with the level of contentedness, which means that my wants in past and present and future all go into the bucket of irrelevant in terms of their ability to affect my perception of reality in the present. And so in thinking about that, it makes my wants have less stake today. And so a lot of anxiety that I think a lot of people have is around things that haven't happened yet, either good or bad. Like, I hope this speech goes well, or I hope I get this job promotion. But the reality is that once you get the job promotion, you wanted it, you resettle. And the negative version of this is, and you've probably seen this stuff, but when handicapped people get handicapped, so they have a terrible accident, they get paralyzed or they lose a leg or whatever, there's a dip in their subjective well-being, but after 3 to 6 months, it typically restabilizes, which means that if I didn't get paralyzed, or even if I did get paralyzed, I'd be just about as content as I am right now. It's like, whatever is about to happen is probably not as bad as that. And so that's the worst case scenario, which is nothing. So, okay.
Good things aren't as good as you think they are. Bad things aren't as bad as you think they are.
Yeah, life is life.
So where does motivation come from? Motivation comes from deprivation. So let me explain. So when are you more motivated to eat, drink water, sleep? When you're hungry, thirsty, and tired. That's when you're the most motivated. Have you ever finished a big meal and been like, man, I could go for another pizza? Probably not. Have you drank a big gallon of water and been like, I don't want any more fluids? Of course not, because you're not deprived. And so when you're full, you don't want it anymore. After you finish Thanksgiving dessert, you're stuffed. Are you still hungry? No. After you drink a bunch of water, do you want more? No. So what does this have to do with motivation to win and make money? I told you, I'll wrap it. I'll move it, right? Because by this logic, wouldn't all poor people be motivated since they're deprived of money, right? That would make sense. But we know that's not the case because the people who make the most money are the ones who keep wanting to make more. Huh. So here's why. You know when you're tired, hungry, or thirsty, you perceive a gap. And your motivation is proportional to your deprivation, how much you don't have, right? Very hungry, like this guy is much hungrier than the person who's just like, maybe I'll have dinner on the way home. And so here's why money motivation is more complicated than hunger or thirst or being sleepy. With money, deprivation is not physiological, it's psychological. You only feel poor if you perceive a large gap between where you are and where you really want to be. So let's say you're at $5,000 a month in income and your desire is to get to $10,000 a month.
Fair enough? Cool. Now let's say this guy is doing $1 million a month in income, but he wants to get to $10 million a month in income. Relative to their goal, one guy is closer. He's only half of his goal. The other guy's 1/10 of his goal. Who's more deprived? Huh. Hang around 5 people with 10 times the net worth that you have, and you'll feel poorer than you ever did when you were poor around poorer people than you.
The reason so few people understand success is consistency never looks impressive in the moment, only at the end. And so people only root for people who don't need it once you've already won. People are like, he's amazing, he's so good. But like, that's the last time you need it, the least. And so you always have to be the person who roots for you before everyone else does. And people struggle to do things alone because if everyone else were cheering you on, then it means that you're not in the right place. It means that you're just like everyone else, and that's not where you want to be.
Like when we enter seasons, I call it, you know, the season of no, which is where you have, I have an extended duration where I say no to almost everything. And most people say that's unbalanced, and they hurl that as though it's a bad thing. They're like, that's so unbalanced. And you're like, yes, that's the point. Because if I had a balanced outcome, then I won't have the outsized return on this one thing. And so, again, like there's so many of these little insults that people will throw at you, like you're unbalanced, you changed, you, that they intend as insults. But if you actually don't take your society programmed response and say, oh, they mean to insult me. But if you actually think about what they're saying something that's true. And then we just need to be okay with that truth because that was the choice we made to begin with. And so I think about that a lot, which is like, how many things do people tell me that they intend to insult me with that I can take as a compliment?
The bigger your goals, the more pain you're going to endure, whether you want to or not. It's the price. And if you can endure 4 times more pain than someone else, I don't actually think that it feels 4 times more painful. I think it feels the same level of pain, but you have this padding that makes it feel worth it. Give a man a purpose and the ability to achieve it, and he will crawl over broken glass with a smile. That broken glass, like how can you have a smile during the pain? It's because of what the pain itself represents. Now I'm gonna get a little bit into behavior because I think it's valuable. I talk a lot about reward and punishment, but those are kind of more colloquial terms. When it comes down to behavior, it's actually reinforcers. A reinforcer can be negative, meaning it can be something that's aversive. So for example, if I know that every time I hit my hand with a hammer, I'm going to grow muscle. Hitting my hand with a hammer or taking the shock for my family means something positive, which is that I'm protecting my family, I'm helping my country, I'm doing something that I deem meaningful. The pain itself can become a positive reinforcer because you know you're making progress towards the thing you want. Now, you might think of that and be like, well, I don't want to have the pain. The thing is that when you're going through it, if you have this frame, it isn't as painful. In a lot of ways, it's like we are our own sculpture that we are working on. And as we chisel away, we also get to reveal the type of person that we want to become, the traits and the behaviors and the belief sets that go with the man or woman that we're trying to grow into.
Experts, some of the biggest reinforcers I've had in my life has been future casting the story that I would tell about the shitty period that I was in. Like, I remember when I was sleeping on the floor at my gym because I didn't have enough money for 2 rents. And I was like, I will fucking tell this story. And when I lost everything for the first time, I have the screenshot of the bank account. Like when I show it, people are like, oh, look, there's that thing. But they forget that there was a person who screenshotted it to be like, this won't fucking happen again. And I think having a larger narrative of where you're ultimately going, one, gives you the vision of where you're knows where he's going. But it allows the dragons that you have to slay along the way, the hard things that you have to overcome, to feed into the larger narrative of the story that you'll someday tell. And so like no one ever tells stories about the hero who made it all happen immediately and had no hardships. No one cares, right? Like, okay, you were born to a billionaire. Is there a story there? Not really. But everyone loves the story because we can see ourselves in the character and how much we hope to be like them. And it's the being like them, not the having what they have, that we usually like. And so reframing ourselves as the hero of that narrative in my harder times was what really got me through that and thinking, I will tell this story someday.
One of the easiest ways to have more money is to work more hours.
And you're like, how is that possible? Well, when you work more hours, it actually kills two birds. One is that you actually make more money when you work more hours. But on top of that, you don't spend money because you have less time to spend it. And so every hour of work is a net positive in two directions. So it saves you money you're not spending and makes you money. And so you want to find those little twists that you can make in your investments of time and money that are outsized. It's not just that you gain, you also stop the loss. I've always been willing to bet big on me. And so a lot of you guys are trying to like bet big on Dogecoin or some meme thing or like some get rich quick. And I promise you, the guys who have all the money know how to do it better than you. And if you have your last $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 that you're like, what do I do with it? Bet on you. Because you'll never sell you. You're a long-term hold, right? And so if you get better, you guarantee the win. And every investment you make compounds. You guarantee compounding because every skill stacks on top of other skills.